Hey, howdy, space nerds. I know it's been a while since we've talked. As I'm sure you all know, Hurricane Irma decided to pay a visit to our state here in Florida and caused quite a bit of damage. As a reporter here at WMFE, I shifted my focus on storm coverage and helping coordinate our coverage afterwards. So that put this show on hold for a bit, but now we're back. And we should be back to a more regular schedule next month. Thanks for being patient, and thanks to all the listeners that reached out to check on all of us here in Florida. That was awesome, and I'm very grateful. All right, on to the show. From the studios at WMFE in Orlando, Florida, this is the Space Exploration Podcast, and ask the question, are we there yet? Hi, I'm Brendan Byrne. What does it take to become an astronaut? Well, that's the question Lauren Grush asked ahead of the production of the new web series, Spacecraft. Lauren is TheVerge.com's space reporter and host of the new web series that explores the tech and training that's taking humans into deep space. We spoke earlier this month about the series and what she learned while producing the show. Lauren, thanks for speaking with us.
Thanks for having me.
Well, give us the rundown. What can viewers expect from this this video series, Spacecraft?
Well, we basically wanted to just touch on the many aspects of what it takes to send people to space or to be an astronaut and go to space. And we do that through the lens of me training to be an astronaut, which has provided for some very hilarious opportunities. The basic, I guess, gist of this would be, you know, let's put Lauren in some really weird astronaut training scenarios and see what happens. And that's what we've come up with.
Was that the idea at the drawing table? Like, how can we embarrass Lauren and put her in these weird situations?
Yeah, basically. The whole time they're like, well, you know, that's great and all, but what can you do? So that kind of guided us throughout the production process.
I mean, one of the things that I noticed was there's this one episode where you get to try on a few different spacesuit prototypes, and I remember watching it and having a panic attack as you were being pressurized in this thing. I mean, what was that like?
Yeah, I mean, just imagine the most claustrophobic place imaginable. And, I mean, it was fine, honestly. I actually, not to toot my own horn, but I've tried on a spacesuit before. So I knew what to expect. But yeah, it's very hot. It gets very hot very fast. You're very enclosed. When they pressurize it, it's actually quite nice because before, everything's kind of clinging to your body, but when they pressurize it, it expands a bit and you have more air in there, so you have more room to breathe, I guess. But then it also introduces new problems, so bending your arms is actually quite difficult because you're working against that pressurization just to bend your elbows. So it really does give you an idea of how difficult it is, or it would be, to work on Mars in one of these types of suits.
So, Lauren, you've been covering this stuff for quite some time now. I mean, did anything on this reporting project, did it surprise you? Was it more interesting than you thought it would be, or something more difficult than you thought it would be?
I guess what I would say is mostly, yeah, I've been reporting on this stuff, so I've seen it in, you know, in videos and whatnot. But yeah, to have that tactile sensation when you're trying on a suit or, you know, working out, just trying out those machines, I mean, from afar, you really don't have a sense of what it feels like. But then when you're actually squatting with this, the ARAD machine, it really does give you a sense of how difficult it is. I think that was the main thing. You know, I knew being an astronaut was difficult, and they make it look easy. But it really goes to show just how in shape you need to be and all the different muscles that you're using. And the different, I mean, and how the different, like, engineering knowledge that you need to know. I mean, there's just, it really does take a whole lot to become an astronaut. And you just I have a newfound respect for it, having just had, like, the littlest of tastes, you know, going in.
And as a journalist, as a storyteller, it's got to be, I mean, there's got to be something about having that, being able to touch the technology and boots on the ground, like literally putting your feet inside the boots. I mean, it's got to help you tell that story of space exploration, no?
Yeah. I think another thing that I've noticed, too, is just getting your feet in the boots, for instance, is slow. So a lot of this stuff is a very slow process, and I think that can that doesn't get illustrated a lot because people, like, especially when you're watching movies, things are moving so fast, you know. But if you watched our Safer demonstration where I'm in VR and they knock me off of the ISS and I have to get back, I mean, just that act of turning around and you know, using my thrusters to get back to the station, I mean, we cut a whole lot of it out. It took me 4 or 5 minutes to do that. You know, in when you're watching the movie Gravity, George Clooney is zooming around in his little Safer backpack, but that's really not, you know, how it works. So it does just show that things are a lot more methodical than you might expect when it comes to, you know, suiting up or moving around in space.
Now, was there a place that you wanted to go in this series that you just weren't able to go to, or you had to cut it for time? I guess what I'm asking is there a chance that there's a spacecraft 2.0? And if there is, where would you go?
Oh, 100% there's going to be a spacecraft 2.0. Where would I like to go? I mean, I would really love to go into the, you know, rocket making process. Mm-hmm. However, I'm pretty sure a lot of that stuff is proprietary, so I'm not sure how much they'll let us do, but we'll see if I can weasel my way in. I'm very persuasive, I've been told.
I would have just jumped into that neutral buoyancy tank when I was there.
I mean, it took a lot of energy not to dip a toe, you know, just one toe right in, but...
I mean, it was really interesting because a lot of the stuff that we cover on this podcast is the mechanics of things, the engineering of things, but this series really looks at the human factors and the biology of things. Was that on your mind when you were planning this, is to cover this from a human perspective, and how does that change the way you tell the story?
Yeah, definitely. I really wanted to show just the kind of toll it takes on your body to go to space. And I think I got that across because I'm just a, you know, regular Joe Smo. And I mean, I work out like any other person, but, you know, I'm not working out to be an astronaut. So I think I really wanted to illustrate just how much you have to do in order to be an astronaut. Because, I mean, the weight of a spacesuit, for instance, I mean, carrying that around gets very tiring. So you're going to have muscles that can support that. So that was the main objective. I really wanted to show just kind of like, you know, when it's a very different process from sending a robot into space versus sending a human into space. There's so many, it just changes the game in terms of what you need to think about and the engineering problems that you have to overcome.
Lauren, what's been the response to this? What are you hearing from viewers?
People seem to love it, and they want more information. I mean, I feel like we've actually had to cut a lot just for time's sake, but yeah, they want to know more, and I'm happy to give them more. So like I said, Spacecraft 2.0 is definitely on the horizon.
Are you hearing from folks that wouldn't normally be following your work? Are these people that are outside the sphere of space news and space information?
Yeah, I think so. And it's always surprising to me the things that they focus on. So in our most recent video, I asked a question about, you know, where does the sweat go when you are sweating during your workout? And of course, the sweat actually clings to your face because of surface tension. So water acts a lot differently in microgravity. But then Bob Tweedy, who is at the countermeasures facility that we were training at, he mentioned that, you know, if you were to fling your face across the room, then the sweat would, you know, it would go across the room, get captured by the recycling system, and then it's tomorrow's coffee. And I swear, everyone has been freaking out about that. The fact that the idea that your sweat gets recycled, and I'm like, well, actually, it's not just your sweat that gets recycled. I mean, it's all wastewater that gets recycled on the International Space Station. So that's been a fun surprise for people to learn. It's just really interesting what people, because see, I knew that, but it's fun to under, you know, to see, oh, you know, not necessarily everybody knows that. And so I like those surprises that people have along the way.
Space is pretty gross, right?
It's not gross if you properly filter the water. That's all they're doing. And if you think about it, we're drinking recycled water here on Earth too. It's not everything. There's the circle of life, if you will.
I mean, what do you think that does to the general population in, you know, kind of raising public support for space programs like that, when you get that little light bulb of curiosity going off into somebody who might not know that. I mean, what does that do for the public perception of our space program?
Overall, I think it's just good for people to understand. And when you talk to people who don't necessarily follow space, you start to understand that there's a lot of misinformation out there, and or they really don't know things that you think might be basic things to know about space. So I think the more that we can educate people, I think the more they're going to be supportive. I mean, it's fun to listen to just my colleagues, and they come at me with things that they've learned through the episodes, and they're just like, wow, that's so interesting. I didn't know that. So, you know, if we can instill some sense of wonder into a few people, I feel like we've done a good job. I mean, there's so many little details like that, you know, that you just really wouldn't think about. One thing we actually didn't get to show, but we learned when we were at the spacesuit lab at NASA's Johnson Space Center, is that astronauts have to actually put mirrors on their wrists in order to read their chest pieces, because they have to, if they need to, like, adjust a knob or something, or if they need to read what setting the knob needs to go to, you know, they can't look down and see it, so they have to actually put their hand up with the mirror, and everything is written backwards on their chest.
Huh.
So it's little things like that, and it's an engineering problem that you wouldn't think about until you actually put a human in the suit, right? So I love those little tidbits of information that we're learning along the way. Just really interesting factoids that you wouldn't necessarily seek out to learn. And that's what a really fun process of, or byproduct of this experience has been.
Now, people might not know this, but both of your parents were involved in the space program. How has that shaped your reporting in general, and also this series?
I have an understanding of what it takes to be an engineer, at least through their eyes. And I guess my perspective is just how much hard work goes into this. Like, what we're showing you is just the tip of the iceberg, you know? And the fact that the stuff that you're seeing took probably, like, years and years of hard work just to get to that point. So I guess that kind of underlines what I'm reporting on. In the end, you know, it's just kind of a respect for what it takes to get to that point.
Now, these are big, lofty goals that you're looking at, you know, rovers on Mars and habitats on different planets. But realistically, I mean, I've got to ask you, since I have you here, what's the next big story you think that's going to come out of the realm of space exploration? What's on the horizon that we need to be looking at?
I really think what's on the horizon is how NASA is going to work with these commercial companies that it's investing in. So I think when SpaceX and Boeing, part of the commercial crew program, start flying, that's going to be a big watershed moment, because people are going to start thinking, okay, so how do we integrate, you know, these new space companies? And, you know, contracting has been a big thing. And as we're moving forward with the new administration, people are debating, okay, so should NASA be doing these cost-plus contracts like they've been doing, or should we be doing the fixed-price contracts like with the commercial crew program? I think that's been such a big debate. And I think, I mean, it's not very sexy, unfortunately. No one really, you know, no one really likes to talk about contracts, but I think it really could change the game in terms of how NASA operates. And it just depends on how they move forward. Right now, I think they're kind of like in a bit of a stasis, you know, they're doing both ways.
Mm-hmm.
But we'll see whether or not they can sustain that moving forward. And I think that'll be kind of like the big story, because, you know, NASA has so many ambitions, and in order to do them, they're going to have to save some money. So it's going to depend on how they procure their services, you know.
Now, just for the benefit of our listeners, can you quickly explain what cost plus and fixed pricing is? Because I think it's really important to understand this, because this could change the way that the agency operates in the next decades.
Right. So, yeah, when it comes to cost plus, I mean, it's kind of the way that NASA's always done that. They've always used outside contractors to build their spacecraft, but they give them these contracts where they can keep giving them money. And then there's a lot of oversight from NASA in the process of building and designing. And then once the vehicle is done, then NASA owns that vehicle at the end of the day, and they are the ones that are operating it. Whereas fixed price is where they give, you know, that's it, a fixed price to a company asking for a service. They're basically ordering a hamburger or whatever, and then it's up to SpaceX or Boeing or whoever to make that hamburger they see fit, and that's kind of how it works. So, and there are pros and cons to doing it both ways. A lot of people think that fixed price saves money because there's competition involved, like with SpaceX and Boeing. There's competition between the two companies, you know, to get those contracts, and then they can try and bring the cost down that way. But then, of course, with cost plus, you know. One thing I learned recently talking to the Orion program manager is that these companies actually use a lot of the data that NASA is getting through the cost plus contracts, you know, so they still work together, and there's still benefits to doing it one way or the other. But yeah, the cost plus can be pricey because you're continually adding money onto it. So yeah, it'll be interesting to see how NASA moves forward, whether they lean more into one form of contracting versus the other.
And aside from the contract debate, I mean, commercial crew, those flights that are going to be crewed, I mean, that is going to drum up so much public interest and public support for the program that, I mean, that in itself is just an incredible return on investment.
Yeah, I think once they start flying, it's hard for people to kind of say that it's going to be a success until it happens, you know? So I think once they start flying, there's going to be a lot of people looking back and saying, like, okay, was this really the best way to go? Because, I mean, if you think about it, commercial crew has been delayed quite a bit. You know, everything suffers from delays. So, yeah, I think once they start flying, there's going to be a lot of analysis of how NASA either benefited or did not benefit from this new strategy. So we'll see. And I think it depends on, honestly, when they launch and how those launches go, you know, because they really have to get those people to the station safe. And I'm not doubting their ability to do that, but you have to do it first, you know.
So, well, before we let you go, Lauren, how can we watch the video series? Tell our listeners where they can go to find it.
Well, we have so many different platforms for you. We have YouTube, which is where the main episodes live. Then we have breakout videos from those episodes on YouTube, on Facebook. And you can also go to TheVerge.com.
Well, Lauren Grush, she's the space reporter over at The Verge and host of its new web series, Spacecraft. Be sure to follow her on Twitter. She's my go-to for space news. Lauren, thank you so much for making time.
Thank you, Brendan. This was great.
Well, that's going to do it for this episode. The conversation continues on Twitter. The show is at AWTY Mars. Get it? Are we there yet, Mars? And I'm at Space Brendan. You can also send us an email. What do you like about the show and what kind of episodes are you hoping for? Email us, arewethereyet@wmfe.org. Support for Are We There Yet comes from the listeners of WMFE. Our theme music was composed by Kevin McLeod. You can find more space news online at wmfe.org/space. Until next time, I'm Brendan Byrne. Thanks for listening.